a whole lot of legal wrangling that he was given a special status, Julie said. Earl is the only non-puff applicable lycanthrope in the world. And even then, he is kind of on probation.
But I thought werewolves were crazy and violent and just killed people at the drop of a hat, I said.
I unconsciously rubbed my hand on my face, only to realize that my scar was no longer there. I lowered my hand, feeling stupid. But he seemed so in control. It all made sense, though. The way he had defeated Darnay so easily on the freighter. The way that he had fought in Natchy Bottom.
Well, he's had a lot of time to work on it, the boss said. He has more control over his abilities than any other one that we know about. On the full moon, he still has to lock himself up because he ain't got no choice but to change then. On the full moon, he just loses it, and it's all animal. He tears the hell out of things, but by morning, he's fine. We got us a concrete room with a steel door in the basement of the compound, built just for him.
On holidays, Milo throws a coin in the cell with him, Nate added helpfully. Kind of like a special Christmas dinner. In the morning, we just hose it down.
He used to lock himself up at the family estate. We had a little building out by the old slave quarters, the boss said. Had to build a new cell when he started to wear it out. He didn't want to get loose and hurt somebody when he wasn't in full control.
I knew exactly which little building he was talking about. It had given me the creeps at the time. All of those marks that I had thought had been made by a tool, they had been frustrated claw marks. But there were millions of scratches in there, I blurted. It had to have taken hundreds of hours to do all that. The three Shacklefords looked at each other, trying to decide what exactly to say. Finally, Julie started to speak.
Not hundreds of hours, but almost that many years.
Huh?
Julie,
Nate said, looking over his shoulder to make sure the other hunters were not in earshot.
You can't tell him about that.
Sorry, bro. In the last few days, Owen has almost destroyed the universe twice to save me. I'm guessing that he can know about the family's secret,
she said politely. The boss nodded for her to proceed.
Earl isn't just a special case. He is the special case. As far as we know, he is the oldest living lycanthrope in the world. He is, quite literally, the king of werewolves. He was bitten back in the 1920s. Over the last 80 years... He has aged maybe 20 years. It took him a real long time to get the hang of it, and to keep from flipping out and killing people like a regular werewolf. That's probably why he smokes so much. When he doesn't get his cigarettes, he gets cranky. When he gets cranky, people get eaten.
Gives a whole new meaning to nicotine fit, Nate quipped. His grandfather groaned. It probably wasn't the first time that joke had been made in the family.
He changes his name every generation, always trying to keep his secrets safe. Only a handful of us know who he really is. My family has protected him the whole time.
I thought back to the Shackelford family estate, and more importantly, the wall of family portraits. There had been only one missing. Conspicuous by its absence. Raymond Shackelford II, I said slowly.
Yep. You're pretty quick for a bean counter. I like this young man, Julie. Much better than your last boyfriend, but I digress. I was only a young man when he was bit, but we stood by my daddy, the boss said. Shackelfords take care of their own.
The other two nodded. He pointed toward the road where some other vehicles were arriving.
Well, it looks like we got some company. Come on, Nate, let's give these two a moment.
He shuffled away, grandson in tow. So let me get this straight. I took Julie by the hand. You hang out with your great-grandfather, who's some sort of mutant super-werewolf. Your mother is a vampire. Your father was a mad genius who almost destroyed the world. Your grandfather is a half-crazed monster hunter with one eye and a stainless steel hook for a hand, and he's the normal one of the bunch. I took a deep breath. Is that about it? Is there any other family weirdness that I need to know about?
No, that's pretty much it,
she answered, looking a little sheepish.
Can you deal with that?
I pulled her close. Julie, at this point you could tell me that you sprout butterfly wings and a third eye on every second Tuesday, and I would still be in love with you.
Good,
she said with a grin.
Well, there's still my Uncle Leroy, but that's complicated. So that story is going to have to wait.
She pointed at the horizon. There were several black shapes approaching. Helicopters. The feds had finally arrived. The Black Hawk set down in the blasted valley. The Apaches circled over the area. The feds did not speak as they fanned out into the forest to stake out the fallen blocks of ivory debris. There were only a handful of MHI staff left at the scene, as almost everybody else had packed up and left. We found the boss arguing with Agent Myers near the original National Guard position. The guardsmen were mostly still there, though their lieutenant had locked himself inside the APC and refused to come out. Agent Frank stood off to the side, listening intently to the radio traffic as his men scoured the forest for anything of interest.
"It's over, Myers. We done killed the damn thing. Biggest puff bounty ever,"
the senior Shackelford shouted.
"See? We didn't need no stinking government help."
"Whatever, you old coot," Myers retorted.
"This is our scene now. Turn in your paperwork to the Puff office for approval. I don't care."
He saw me approaching.
"Mr. Pitt, what happened to your face?"
Agent Franks looked up and scowled at me. Once again, he was the ugliest man in our line of work.
"Ha ha, sucker."
I ignored the comment.
"It's over, Myers. The cursed one is dead. His body's out there with the rubble, along with that artifact."
I pointed in the direction I thought most of the pocket dimension had landed in.
"If you find it, I suggest you don't play with it. Just put it some safe place and leave it the hell alone."
"That's our business now. Don't you worry. It'll be in good hands. Now get out," he ordered. "This scene is our jurisdiction."
"Fine, but I'm warning you. That box is a lot more than you can handle."
I nodded at Franks.
"A bunch of your men were killed in that cavern. Turned into whites. You had best see to them."
Franks nodded in understanding. I think that we had come to terms.
"Earl!"
Julie shouted. She pointed toward the trees.
"He's alive!"
Sure enough, Harbinger came walking through the trees. Dirty, caked in mud, grass, and leaves, dried blood matted over most of his body. He was totally naked, but did not seem to care. He walked past the feds, most of whom stepped away from him, slightly fearful. He strode directly up to us, stopping only a few feet from Myers.
"Hey, Myers!"
"Earl?"
"Got a smoke?"
Myers nodded nervously, took out a pack, and handed over a cigarette. The senior agent handed over his lighter as well. Harbinger took a drag and sighed contentedly. He looked like a nightmare wild man of the forest, but he did not care in the slightest.
"It's good to have lungs that regenerate," he said. "So, Myers, we've done your job. The threat's dead. The vampires are dead. I suppose right about now MHI is on your boss's good side. I'm guessing we're square."
The Fed hesitated, not really wanting to answer.
"I suppose so." "Full access to fulfill our contracts?"
"Agreed."
"My teams can move freely?"
"Fine."
"Call off OSHA, the EPA, Fish and Game, ATF?"
"I'll see what I can do."
"IRS?"
Harbinger removed the cigarette and blew smoke out his nose. He absently scratched himself.
"I bet some certain committee heads are loving us right about now. Probably even the senators who need to approve the appointment of the next head of the Monster Control Bureau."
Myers looked like he had a foul taste in his mouth.
"Fine, I'll call off the heat. You're golden for now. But when your people screw up again, your asses are mine."
"Buddy, you should never tell a naked man that his ass is yours," Harbinger said, totally deadpan. Frank snorted. I think it was almost a human laugh. Myers whirled around and glared at his subordinate.
"I've got just one question for you."
"What?" Myers snapped, visibly agitated.
"Once the battle started and everything went down here, how come you guys didn't just nuke the place to be sure?"
"Who says we didn't try?" Myers answered cryptically. He turned his back on Harbinger and stomped away.
"Hey, Franks,"
Julie called out to the silent Fed.
"Yeah,"
he grunted.
"I heard that you guys didn't cut my dad's head off. I heard that you let him turn, and that he escaped,"
Julie asked. There was a current of anger in her voice.
"Because if that was true, I would be disappointed. So is he still alive?"
Franks took his time composing an answer. His cold eyes studied us.
"No."
He nodded grimly, then followed after his boss. We watched him go.
"Think he's lying?" I asked.
"I don't know,"
Julie answered.
"I'm sure we'll find out soon enough."
"I know one thing for sure," I said slowly.
The others waited.
"I know we need to get Earl some pants."
The King of the Werewolves laughed. We stopped by the National Guard soldiers to thank them for their help in the battle. Sergeant Gregorius was offered a business card and invited to come see us if he was interested in a lucrative career in beating down evil. Turns out that Boone had already done the sales pitch, and the big soldier had already volunteered for the next newbie class. I was not surprised. For people like us, monster hunting is a calling. The compound was somber that day as we held 15 funerals. The fallen were decapitated, cremated, and their remains sent back to their families, along with whatever the made-up excuse was for that particular hunter. Sometimes having a job that had to be kept secret from most of the world was a real bummer. The team leads had to make the phone calls, and I did not envy them at all. The next few days were quiet ones. There were far too many new plaques on the wall. We watched the news anxiously, just like everybody else in the world. Gradually, the panic over the missing 5 minutes died down, and people, being people, moved past it. Cults were formed, wars were started, nutcases blew stuff up, books were written, theories published, and everyone came away with their own interpretation of the events. As for MHI, we just kept our big mouths shut. Milo's wedding reception had mutated into one heck of a party. The compound had been decorated and looked pretty festive for a paramilitary fortress hidden in the backwoods. It was good to have many of the MHI staff united again, this time under much happier circumstances. The amazing newbie squad sat around a table off to one side in the boisterous cafeteria. Holly was in the process of getting wasted. Trip was frowning in disapproval. Lee was tapping his cane on the floor in time with the music. The dance floor was crowded, and Milo and his new bride appeared to be dancing a cross between the Hokey Pokey and the Funky Chicken.
"So are you going to take Earl's offer?"
I asked Lee, shouting over the noise. He sighed, distracted from the spectacle.
"I suppose. I've been on exactly 3 missions and been injured on all of them. Dr. Nelson says my leg is going to have permanent nerve damage."
He held up his cane and shook it.
"I can't be out there beating monster ass with you guys anymore, so I would be a sucker not to take it."
"Good. You're the best man for the job. The archives will be in good hands,"
Tripp stated. He looked strange with the shaved head, but the dreads had to go to make room for bandages after the battle at DeSoya Caverns. Personally, I thought Tripp looked better. Apparently, Holly thought so as well.
"Tripp, you sexy geek. Damn it, let's dance."
She stood up and grabbed his hand. He began to protest, weakly, but he was no match for a determined Holly. I had to laugh as she dragged him out on the dance floor. They made a weird couple.
"Hey."
I felt a hand fall on my shoulder. It was Harbinger, looking slightly inebriated and unusually happy. He tossed a small object on the table.
"Here."
"What's up, Earl?"
I asked as I picked it up.
"It's official. Grant's turned in his resignation. Moving to Hollywood to consult on a big horror movie or some nonsense,"
he snorted. Grant had not been his usual cocky self since his kidnapping, and he had never spoken about what he had seen or experienced while in the vampire's clutches. I was not surprised to see him go, but I was surprised to discover I might actually miss him. Almost.
"Sam's heading out to set up the new team in Denver, so I'm really short-handed."
I studied the little flat object.
"And this way you can keep an eye on me?"
"Promise not to destroy the world or anything, and we shouldn't have a problem."
He winked at me and left. I twirled the patch between my fingers. I would wear the green happy face with pride. It was a few months later, right after Harbinger's team had returned from a difficult contract in the Philippines. Julie and I were at the Shackelford ancestral home. I had volunteered to help her work on the renovations to the old house. I was not particularly skilled at home repair, but I could do manual labor with the best of them. Mostly, I loved the opportunity it gave me to spend time with her. I had bought an engagement ring, but so far I had not worked up the courage to actually ask her. Wrestle with ancient evil, fight Aswangs, blow up lindworms, or fish for luscas? No problem. Ask the woman I love to marry me? Terrifying. We were sitting in the formal living room. The paint was drying, and I had to admit that it was going to look great. We had returned the missing portrait of Raymond Shackelford, Jr. to its spot on the wall. We weren't expecting guests, and having the blank spot kind of ruined the symmetry. I had joked that we should just paint a beard and glasses on Earl's picture so that we wouldn't have to worry about taking it down when company came over. I could tell that Julie had been tempted. It was about 11 p.m. when there was a loud knock on the door.
"Somebody's here,"
I said stupidly. Julie was startled from the couch. She reached above the mantel and took down the hidden shotgun, tossed it over to me, and without thinking, I caught it. She took down a carbine and checked the chamber.
"Perimeter alarm didn't sound," she said quickly.
"Ah, hell." I pumped the 870 and started for the front door. "What now?" The front entryway smelled of wood glue and sawdust. I approached the door and signaled silently for her to cover me. Julie moved to the side and took up a position behind one of the interior columns. I unlocked the 5 heavy deadbolts. The ornate doorknob was unusually cold under my fingertips. I kept my right hand on the grip of the shotgun and kept it ready. I turned the knob and yanked the door open. I stepped back, ready to fire. Nothing. I sliced the pie, slowly cornering around the opening. The porch was clear. I shined the weapon-mounted light into the darkness. I could not see anything in the yard or in the parking area. "Did we just get doorbell ditched?" I asked.
"Wait, there's a note."
Julie approached cautiously. A small white envelope had been shoved under the door. She cradled the carbine in her arms as she tore it open.
"Careful," I cautioned.
"Don't be such a wuss."
She unfolded the note, adjusted her glasses, and read silently. Julie frowned. Her pretty features drew into an anxious knot, and she absently rubbed the unnatural black line on the side of her neck, a habit that she had picked up when she was nervous.
"What is it, honey?"
I asked. She passed the note over. The letter was handwritten. There were 2 separate messages on the single sheet of paper, with 2 very different writing styles. The first was almost perfect calligraphy.
"Dear Julie, we just wanted to drop you a note to let you know that we are doing fine. Your daddy is adjusting to his new lifestyle rather well. He has a real flair for it. We have been traveling and seeing the world just like we always talked about doing, but never found the time. Now we have all of the time in the world. We want to offer a truce. I hope there are no hard feelings about the little incident we had. As a mom, I just want what is best for all of my children. Now I see that you need to live your life on your own and make your own decisions, no matter how foolish they may be. You need to learn from your own mistakes. I wish that I could be at the wedding. I like this Owen. He is a good man. He will be a good husband. If you are wondering what wedding, silly me, I have to realize that you can't read minds. Your poor boyfriend broadcasts his thoughts so loudly that I could pick them up from Mexico. The ring is in the armory. It is rather pretty. Congratulations. One last offer, as you grow old and approach your mortal end, or if your health is fleeing and creeping sickness overtakes your body, if you choose not the cold embrace of death, call upon me, and I will come. You are my daughter, and my offer of immortality still stands. Until that time, if you avoid us, we will avoid you. Search for me, and I will kill you and destroy everything that you hold dear with a vengeance terrible beyond your imagination. Love, Mom. P.S. I love what you've done with the old place."
The second message was shorter. The writing was blocky and erratic.
"Hey, kids. How's everything going? I hope y'all are well. I'm doing good. Susan is doing good. We are having lots of fun. I'm still real sorry about the whole thing with the lying and sending you to your deaths in Natchee Bottom, but I had to do it.
I hope you understand. No hard feelings. See you around. Love, Dad. P.S. Kid, treat my girl good, or I'll rip out your heart.
I folded the note, stuck it in the envelope, and passed it back. Julie crumpled it into a ball and threw it out the door. I slammed it closed. And to think that regular people bitch about their in-laws, I said. I figure I've got to hold some sort of record on this one. Julie set her gun against the wall. She fell into my arms with a sigh. I held her tight.
"Do you still think normal people suck?"
she asked me. I thought about it for a moment. Yes. Yes, I do. Normal people suck. Monster hunting is where it's at.
Good. I agree.
We kissed. Vampire mother-in-law be damned.
So where exactly is this ring?
Downstairs, I replied nervously. I had had it for weeks. The thought of her saying no was terrifying.
Owen.
What, Julie?
Yes.
Epilogue. Special Agent Dwayne Myers, interim head of the Monster Control Bureau, had in fact called in his final option when they had discovered through the actions of MHI that the place of power was just outside of Childersburg, Alabama. As the moon had approached its zenith, the B-1 bomber on station over Alabama had been ordered to release its payload of a single low-yield tactical nuclear device. It was only a 5-kiloton weapon, but it would have been of sufficient strength to slag the area immediately around the DeSoya Caverns Park. Had final option gone according to plan, it would not have stopped the old one's plot, since the pocket dimension was separated from the normal world until the final close of the ceremony. When released, the bomb had a clear path to impact. It was programmable to airburst for maximum surface devastation or to strike the ground first for more penetration. Since Special Agent Myers believed the target to be inside the underground cave, he had ordered the bomb to strike as deeply as possible before detonation. By the time the bomb had traveled its course, the rift between worlds had been prepared. The sphere of evil energy had grown to mammoth size. The old ones could not cross the rift into our world, but matter from our world could enter into theirs. The 5-kiloton nuclear weapon passed cleanly through the rift and entered the plane of the old ones. The resulting explosion split the individual atoms of a legion of the Old One's elite troops, and the edge of the blast singed the carapace of the Overlord itself. This was a grave offense. It called upon its minions to sally forth and destroy the human world utterly, but in those final moments the rift closed, cutting off entrance for another 500 years. Greatly offended by this slight, it called upon its many servants, demanding an explanation of how the feeble mammals had been able to actually cause a small bit of harm to an old one. The 10,000-foot-tall crustacean commanded them to discern the cause of the explosion. The minions searched, trying to discover what foul creature could do such a thing. Though their contact with the human world was limited, they were able to piece together a few clues. They were mostly incorrect and confused, but they were happy to give their dread overlord an answer, hoping to keep from being flayed alive for eons. It did not take kindly to failure. They reported back that the attack must have come from a lone human. It was a single mammal who had dared to launch a feeble atom weapon into their plane of existence. The Dread Overlord was joyous to hear that the perpetrator had been identified, so it only devoured a few dozen of its minions. They were digested painfully for an eternity. It ordered a message sent to the world of the humans. There were still ways to send information, and there were a handful of servants on the human world able to listen and obey. The message was sent across space and time. To all minions of the Overlord, find and utterly destroy the human hunter known as Owen Zastava Pitt.
This has been an Audible Frontiers production. Executive producer, Steve Feldberg. Producer, Mike Charzik. Music by Michael Whalen. Copyright 2009 by Larry Correa. Audio recording copyright 2011 by Audible Inc.
And now a free preview of Monster Hunter Vendetta, Book 2 in the Monster Hunter series.
Chapter 1. It was less than a year ago that the illusion shattered and I got my welcome to the real world. Up until that point, I considered myself perfectly average, living a normal life with a regular career. That all changed the night my accounting supervisor turned into a werewolf and tried to eat me. Now, there are basically two ways to deal with such a problem. Most people confronted with something so hideously impossible tend to curl up into the fetal position and die. On the other hand, those of us destined to become monster hunters simply take care of business. He almost ended my life, but I tossed him out a 14th-story window. He died. I didn't. That makes me the winner. After that initial encounter, I was approached with a job offer. Apparently, survivors like me aren't that common, and as a result, killing a monster is a real resume builder. I was recruited by Monster Hunter International, the premier eradication company in the business. We protect mankind from the unnatural forces that come crawling out from our darkest nightmares, and in return, we get paid the big bucks. It wasn't that long after I started my new job that MHI came up against an unfathomable evil from the past. It took everything we had to survive, but in the end, the Cursed One was defeated, and I literally saved the world. I was Employee of the Month. The biggest chupacabra in the pack was only 4 feet tall. But what they lacked in mass, they made up for in sheer ferocity. Being unable to get to their dinner was making them even surlier than usual. The peasant girl had been futilely tinkering with the engine of her broken-down Chevy Vega when the first chupacabra had come sniffing onto the jungle road. Her screams at seeing the little demon lizard insect thing hop down the dirt lane like a demented miniature kangaroo had driven it into a frenzy, and she had barely managed to dive into the car ahead of its snapping jaws. Her continued cries from behind the locked doors of the old rust bucket had attracted the rest of the pack, and now there were a dozen of the creatures clambering on the car. Chupacabras do not normally attack people. The puncture tubes that jut from their mouths could pierce a human skull like a screwdriver through a milk jug, but instinctively they stick to preying on small animals. Once a chupacabra pack has tasted human blood, however, they absolutely will not stop, and killings become more and more frequent. From what I have seen in this business, people must be either extremely tasty or addictive, like monster crack. The creatures were scratching and clawing at the car's windows and roof. The girl just kept on screaming. She had a remarkably good set of lungs for this kind of thing, which is why we'd picked her. Her cries spurred the monsters on, and they all began to shriek as well, echoing across the dark jungle canopy for miles. The four-footer jumping up and down on the hood of the Vega was pissed. It had to be the pack's alpha male, and it couldn't figure out why the glass wasn't breaking. I watched it carefully through the night vision binocular.
"I think he suspects something,"
Trip Jones whispered. I nodded. They might be clever for creatures with brains the size of tangerines, but the goatsuckers had never run into bulletproof glass before. Finally, the Alpha hopped off the car and scurried over to the side of the road. I almost keyed my radio, but he hesitated there, looking for something, and came up with a rock. He crawled back on the hood, raised the rock, and started banging away at the windshield. The others cheered and hooted him on.
"Hey, I didn't know suckers knew how to use tools,"
Milo Anderson said over the radio. He was positioned on the other side of the road. All of us were wearing ghillie suits over our body armor and had been lying in the underbrush being eaten by insects for hours. The foul-smelling grease that we had rubbed on ourselves earlier to hide our smell from the chupacabra's sensitive noses also served as seasoning for the region's bugs. My radio crackled.
"We'll have to update the database," Julie Shackelford replied. The roar of the chopper's engine could be heard behind her. "Tool use? That's fascinating."
Apparently our fake peasant, Holly Newcastle, didn't think it was nearly as fascinating from her position as Bait in the front seat of the Vega. The theatrical screaming stopped for a moment.
Guys?
The rest of us could hear the glass cracking in the background.
"Guys?"
We had three members of Monster Hunter International hiding in the brush, one in the decoy car, two more on the rapidly approaching attack helicopter, carefully positioned claymores along the roadside, piles of guns, thousands of rounds of ammo, state-of-the-art night vision and thermal imaging equipment, a lot of attitude, and a general dislike of evil beasties. I keyed my microphone. Execute. "My name is Owen Zastava Pitt, and I kill monsters for a living."
"This is Harbinger," the familiar voice said through the phone, sounding a little groggy. I must have woken him. "What time is it?"
"It's almost midnight here," I answered, which meant that it was like 1 or 2 in the morning in Alabama. I was never very good at remembering time zones. There was a brief pause.
"So somebody's either got eaten or you completed the contract."
"Mission accomplished, Chief. Julie's dropping the evidence off at the mayor's office and arranging the funds transfer."
The evidence consisted of a burlap sack full of severed chupacabra heads.
It was a big pack. Smoked them all.
"Nice."
This had been a lucrative job. The Mexican resort depended on tourism, so when people started getting their organs liquefied and drained, it was bad for business, especially since it was happening during their busy season. It was spring break, after all.
"Everybody okay?"
"They're good."
Loud music drifted in through the open window of my hotel room. There was a wild party going on around the Olympic-sized pool, populated mostly by American college students engaged in all manner of drunken debauchery.
"Looking forward to payday, I bet."
"Rush jobs always pay well. How'd the team do?"
Earl asked. I knew what he really wanted to ask was how his team did without him. The timing of the mission had just not worked out, as there were very few places that were safe for him during a full moon.
"They were awesome. It was beautiful."
Exploding chupacabras were not what most people would find artistic, but I knew Earl would understand. He was, after all, the director of operations for a company whose mission statement actually read, "Evil looms. Cowboy up. Kill it. Get paid."
"Wish I could have been there, but you know how it is. Good work, Z."
That comment made me swell with pride. My boss wasn't known for giving compliments. This had been the first operation that I had been allowed to plan entirely, and it had been a success. Well, I had the very experienced Julie and Milo there to make sure I didn't screw it up, but I had still done pretty damn good. Thanks, Earl. See you tomorrow. Night, kid. Tell Julie I love her. And next time, call me in the morning. I tossed the sat phone on the bed next to my body armor and weapons. I still needed to clean my guns before I packed them up for the return flight. It had been humid out in the forest, and rust was my enemy. But right now I didn't feel like doing the work. I just wanted to gloat. Picking up my heavy Kevlar suit, I paused to brush some chupacabra juice off the patch stuck on the arm. It was a little green happy face with devil horns. Just a simple logo, but for me it represented a lot of hard work. It was MHI's unofficial logo, and the only hunters who got to wear it were the ones chosen for Harbinger's personal team. I grinned and dropped the armor back on the bed. I'd earned that patch a few times over. The complimentary hotel room was extremely nice, way nicer than the roach motels that MHI usually seemed to stay in, but I was still too charged up from today's mission to relax. I opened the glass doors and stepped onto the balcony. The hip-hop music was louder now, and the cloud that drifted up from the pool area was strong enough to give a DEA dog a seizure. My room was on the second floor. There had to be a couple hundred people down there, most of them young Americans. An obnoxious crowd had gathered around the DJ table, and a film crew was doing an interview with some rapper who was about to host a wet T-shirt contest or something. An inebriated young woman screamed, lifted her shirt, and flashed me. I waved stupidly. Good old spring break. Life was good. Monster Hunter International was the best private monster hunting company on the planet. I had not even been doing this for a year, but already I was planning and executing operations in foreign countries, and I had just been complimented by the most experienced hunter in the world. Not bad for a guy who was basically just an accountant who happened to be handy with a gun. The wood deck was cool under my bare feet. I leaned on the balcony, directly above the stenciled sign that stated in both English and Spanish that it was not safe to lean on the balcony, and did a quick search of the swimsuited, dancing throng. I could not see any of my team. That wasn't really a surprise, though. Milo and Skippy were probably checking the chopper for the trip home tomorrow. Neither one would be into this scene, especially Skippy, because he wasn't human and was very uncomfortable around crowds. Milo's wife was pregnant and due any time now, so he just wanted to get home as fast as he could. Tripp was definitely not the party type. He had picked up the only fantasy novel available in the hotel gift shop, some ridiculous L.H. Franzibald thing, and was probably squirreled away in his room reading like usual. He is such a nerd. And that's coming from an accountant. Holly definitely gave the impression of being a party girl, but with her, who knew? You could tell me that Holly was helping the nuns at the local orphanage, or you could tell me that she was dancing on the bar for tips, and either story would be equally plausible. Julie would be coming straight back here when she finished harassing the local officials for our money. I had planned on going with her, but since I had been the one to saw off the goat-sucker's heads, Julie had ordered me to return here and take a shower. Chupacabras are rather nasty little buggers. My girlfriend, correction, fiancé, would be back soon enough. I was still getting used to the idea of being engaged. We'd skipped the party scene. For me, personally, I had spent too many years bouncing rowdy drunks to ever want to be a rowdy drunk. It was satisfying to know that it had been me and my friends who had kept any of the tourists below from getting killed. Certainly some of them were going to be dead from alcohol poisoning by tomorrow morning, but that sounded like a personal problem to me. As long as none of them were eaten by chupacabras, it was out of my hands.
My back patting was interrupted by a hard knock on the door. Julie had probably finished collecting our paycheck and returned. I was looking forward to having some alone time with her. If I had been thinking, I would have lit some candles and put on some romantic music or something to take advantage of our free pseudo-vacation, but I was never very good at thinking of those kinds of things beforehand. I left the balcony, closed the double doors, drew the thick curtains mostly shut, and started across the suite. The bass continued to thump through the glass.
"Who is it?" I shouted.
"Is that Owen Zastava Pitt?"
came the muffled response. Shoot, not Julie. The voice was unfamiliar. Frowning, I paused by the bed, picked up one of my STI pistols, the long slide 45, and held it down by my leg. I was paranoid back when I was an accountant. As a monster hunter, I took paranoia to whole new levels. We were registered here under the Shackelford name, and Julie was the one who had done the negotiating with the resort. I couldn't think of anyone other than my teammates here who would know my name.
"Yeah? What do you want?"
"Mr. Pitt, I've traveled a long way to meet you."
The voice had an English accent, not one of those prim and proper Masterpiece Theater ones, but more like someone who had grown up on the tough side of town.
"May I come in?"
One thing that I had learned in this job, you never give an invitation to the unknown.
"Look, dude, whatever you're selling, I don't want any."
Moving as quietly as possible, I went to the peephole. The mystery man's face was distorted through the bubble glass. The hall lights must have gone out, and he was cloaked in shadow. I could only see eyes and the outline of a face. He did not look like the friendly type. But then again, neither was I. He must have caught the darkening of the peephole and automatically glanced up, scowling as if he was thinking really hard about something. There was no way he could see me, but I felt shivers go down my spine as I just knew he was staring me down.
"Ah, yes. You are the one."
The door shook in its frame. Startled, I jumped back and raised my pistol. The shaking increased in intensity, threatening to vibrate the door to pieces. There was a crack as wood broke. I snapped the STI into position.
"Back off! I'm warning you!"
Every light bulb in the room popped. Sparks flew from the wall sconces, plunging the room into darkness. There was a splintering noise as the door frame cracked. Truly freaked out at this point, I jerked the trigger and fired two quick rounds through the center of the door. I knew that the sturdy hotel door would barely slow the 230-grain silver lead bullets, and whoever was pulling my door off the hinges surely must have been hit. The door quit shaking. Instinctively, I moved back. I had dealt with enough supernatural bullshit by this point in my life that it just seemed like the reasonable thing to do. Hunching down behind the bed, I wished that I was wearing my armor instead of a pair of shorts and a t-shirt. The music from the pool area continued, cranked so absurdly loud that the other guests had probably not even heard the gunshots. Blinking rapidly as my eyes adjusted to the sudden gloom, my pistol pointed at the door, I waited. There was an M3 flashlight mounted on the dust cover of my .45. I put my finger on the activation switch. Anything that came through that door was going to get lit up, both with blinding light and bullets, maybe even in that order. "Come on," I muttered under my breath. There was a terrible boom, and the door flew from its hinges and crashed to the floor. A giant shape flowed into the room, so vast and tall that it gave the impression of having to duck to clear the frame. It straightened up, towering above me, formless and terrifying, with the consistency of smoke, a blob of pitch-black intimidation. I had never seen anything like it before. I activated the flashlight, flooding the room with brilliant white light. I blinked in surprise.
The giant shadow was gone, and a normal man stood glaring at me. He was skinny, tough-looking, probably in his mid-30s, with a nearly shaved head and a mean skull. He was dressed in black jeans and a gray hooded sweatshirt, casual enough to fit in with the crowd outside. He held up one hand to protect his eyes. "Don't move," I ordered, hunkered low behind the bed, my glowing tritium front sight centered in the middle of his chest.
"So this is the Great Hunter," he said calmly. "For somebody who's supposed to be so extraordinarily important, you seem rather unimpressive."
He swept his hand downward sharply. The bulb in my flashlight exploded. "Neat trick," I said as I pulled the trigger. But he was already gone. Giant hands wrapped around my biceps, jerked me to my feet and slung me into the wall. A brutal chill flowed up my arm as he yanked the gun from my hand, almost taking my trigger finger with it. I threw an elbow, but touched nothing. He hit me again, low in my side, and it rocked me. The blow was cold as ice and hard as a hammer. I gasped in pain. I'm not exaggerating when I say that I am a mean son of a bitch when it comes to fighting. I can throw down against the best of them. And I had done it in the dark before. There was no time for thought, only action. I came back quick, lashing out at where my opponent should have been. I stumbled into the bed. There was a swish of air as he moved around me. I threw a fist back and missed, and was rewarded with a mighty blow to my shoulders. I kicked out, only to have something cold and impossibly big latch onto my leg. He pulled hard. Off balance, I fell, grunting on impact. This hotel had some solid floors. He grabbed me by the front of my shirt and lifted me with ease. I tried to grasp his hands to apply a wrist lock, but there was nothing there. He crushed me against the wall with brute force, pushing me through a layer of drywall. "I'm taking you with me, Hunter, whether you like it or not." The Englishman's voice seemed to radiate from all around me. There was a frigid weight pushing against my chest as I swung my forearm through it in vain. The darkness swirled around my arm like smoke, and the pressure increased on my lungs, making it impossible to breathe. My back slid up the wall, and I left the ground. I panicked. I lashed out with my feet, my knees, my elbows, my fists, but it was like moving through water. Whatever had me trapped was incorporeal, and I was blacking out.
"It's useless," he chuckled through my futile strikes. "I can't believe you're the one. This is pathetic. I was at least expecting a fight. Can you truly be the one who defeated Lord Machado?"
"That name. Not again. No, not again." The bad chemical taste of fear was suddenly in my mouth. My body was hoisted effortlessly into the air and tossed casually across the room. I slammed into the wall near the bathroom and crumpled to the carpet. My head was swimming, but I immediately began to crawl toward my stash of weapons on the bed. Now that I was a few feet away, I could see the giant shadow shape moving across the room, almost as if it were pacing, agitated. My assailant continued to speak.
"You must be important, though. It took some time for the message to reach me. I was shocked to receive something from the other side. You have no idea how rare it is for the old ones to take the time to communicate with this world."
"Ah, the Dread Overlord is going to be happy when I deliver you. I don't know how you managed to get on his bad books, but you're bloody well fucked."
As the big shadow moved, it passed in front of the sliver of light emanating from the balcony curtains. The shape was gone, and it was just the man again. But as he left the light, his body seemed to drift into smoke, and the shadow returned. Light. I need light. Whatever he was, he only seemed to have a body in the light.
The old ones can kiss my ass, stupid mollusks. I reached the bed, but the shadow was on me in an instant, freezing tendrils clamped around my wrist. He jerked me around and dragged me across the floor toward the exit. Time to go. The Overlord awaits. I thrashed, fought, but only managed to give myself a nasty carpet burn. There was a flicker of green light across the room. The black force around my wrist coalesced into normal human fingers. He was flesh again. The Shadow Man frowned. Fireworks. They were setting off fireworks at the party. My bare foot collided with his ribs. He stumbled back from the brutal kick, falling through the bathroom door. With no time to spare, I leapt up, reached the bed, and searched through the dark for a weapon. My hand closed around the leather-wrapped handle of my Ganga Ram, a Himalayan kukri. I jerked the massive knife from the scabbard. A metallic screeching noise came from the shadows of the bathroom as something was torn free. The next firework blossomed red. The illumination was just enough for me to see the flash of a large white object hurtling at me. Flinging myself down, I could feel the wind as the toilet barely missed my head. It shattered the balcony door, tore through the curtains, and flew into the night. More light from the party flooded into the room. The black shape glided out of the bathroom toward me, but it shrunk into the form of the Englishman as he left the shadows. He charged with a roar. "Oh, it's on now," I grunted as I got back to my feet and drove my knife forward. His face registered the shock as the curved blade of the Ganga Ram slammed through his ribs and out his back. He looked down in surprise. I twisted the blade with all my might, cutting upward through his torso. I've managed to hack a few things to death with this knife over the last year. I should have been splattered with blood, but there was nothing. No liquid at all. It was like I was sawing through a bone-in ham. He glared back up, eyebrows creasing together in rage as more fireworks exploded outside and clamped a brutal hand around my throat. The air to my brain was choked off as he hoisted me off the floor. With a foot of steel driven through his guts, he shouted in my face, "I tried to be polite, and now you have to make me do this the hard way. I wanted to deliver you to the old ones with your mind in one piece, but no, you have to be difficult." I continued to saw the blade back and forth, searching for his heart, but he didn't seem to notice. "Fine, then. We'll just devour your brain and give the old ones a vegetable. They don't respect humans enough to know the difference anyway." He paused as his neck suddenly ballooned up like a pufferfish. "Snack time, little friend." He opened his mouth wide, tilting his head back, and some thing came up his throat, black claws pushing past his lips, tiny red eyes blinking into existence over a circular mouth filled with fishhook teeth, crawling, struggling upward, heading right for my face. And strangely enough, I somehow could tell it was hungry. "Screw that." I yanked the kukri out of his chest, lifted it high overhead, and swung down, chopping his hand off at the wrist. I fell to the floor, gasping for air as the pressure was released from my throat. His running shoe collided with my stomach as he punted me across the room. I rolled painfully to a stop by the balcony, realized that his severed hand was still clawing at my neck, and tore it away. The little shadow monster crawling out of the Englishman's mouth shrieked in an insanely high pitch as he seemed to choke it back down, and with a hard swallow, it was gone. He raised the stump of his ruined arm. Writhing shadow leapt from the end, instantly twisting and reforming into a new hand. He balled the fresh hand into a fist, lowered his head, and started toward me. A man has to know his limitations, and I was way out of my league on this one. Instantly back to my feet, I ran for the balcony, bare feet.